Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, incorporating Mazda's customer-centric vehicle design by making the customer the center of business to create a better car buying experience. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com. This is Charlotte Talks. I'm Mike Collins. Monday afternoon was deadly in Charlotte. A shootout broke out as U.S. Marshals Task Force, along with members of other law enforcement agencies, including CMPD, tried to serve warrants to a suspect on Galway Drive in East Charlotte. It left four officers dead and another four injured. The suspect was also killed. CMPD Chief Johnny Jennings.
They knew what they were going into and still held their own. An attempt to apprehend this suspect.
This incident became one of the deadliest for law enforcement in years. It unfolded in a quiet suburban neighborhood, which quickly reverberated with what one area resident described as about 100 gunshots that sounded like World War III. WBTV spoke with another neighbor, Tyler Wilson, who said the shootout lasted for 30 minutes.
There was shots ringing left and right. We had SWAT and U.S. Marshals set up snipers in our bedrooms. There was an officer got drugged by his arms to our house.
Police quickly shut down the neighborhood, placed nearby schools on lockdown as SWAT teams arrived on the scene. An emotional Charlotte Mayor Vi Lyles spoke to reporters Monday afternoon.
You know, three people lost their lives today. And the most that I can ask of our community is that we honor and respect them.
She mentioned three officers. A fourth officer died that evening, CMPD's Joshua Iyer. These incidents are always shocking, and they are all too frequent. Often what reports tell us as these incidents unfold are sketchy because the reporting is happening in the moment. So this hour, we put the pieces together and fill you in on what we know that we didn't know on Monday with some of the reporters that were on the scene. WFAE's Nick Delacanal reported on the incident as it unfolded on Monday. WBTV's chief investigative reporter Nick Oxner was at the scene. Both are with us this morning, but first we're going to spend a few minutes with CMPD Chief Johnny Jennings. I think I can speak for the whole city, Chief, in offering condolences for your loss and your department's loss, and for the loss experienced by the families and friends of the officers who lost their lives in the line of duty on Monday. Thank you for being here this morning. Welcome.
Thank you, Mike. Appreciate you having me.
How are you and the members of your department this morning?
I mean, it's tough. A lot of it is dealing with things on the fly. So you really, sometimes you don't have time to sit and think about your own emotions. But when you do, you have to really gather yourself and understand that at some point you might need to talk with someone. You may not be able to get through this yourself. And we want to make sure we have all those resources available for our men and women who go out and do such a fine job every single day to keep our community safe.
Do they avail themselves of those opportunities? Because we've talked about this a lot with regard to mental health, and particularly people in uniform in the military, et cetera, that those services are there, but some people are reluctant to avail themselves of them. What's the situation with police departments?
Oh, it's getting much better. We, over the years since I've been a police officer for 32 years, just to see where we are with the stigma related to mental health, with law enforcement, it's come so far along. Also with us being able to hire a specialist a group of specialists actually to help with behavioral health. You know, Ashley Higgins does a fantastic job for us to make sure that those resources are available. We've even created a wellness group with a deputy chief overseeing that, which has never been done before in our department. So as we continue to put those resources out and advertise those, and also to have more people come forward and say, I've used them and they helped me, and that kind of helps reduce that stigma as well. But we've seen a tremendous upswing in that.
I'm sure that you have had a chance to speak with members of Officer Joshua Iyer's family. What did you say to them? How are they holding up?
Yeah, I mean, it's difficult. I mean, what can you say? You know, I hugged Joshua's wife and Just to let her know that we're here, that we're going to be family, and we'll make sure that anything that she needs, that we'll take care of. I'm sure I'll speak with her again, but that was while we were at the hospital. I had the privilege to be able to sit and meet with her. What's painful is to think about, he has a 3-year-old son that has lost his dad. And that's one of the hardest things as a police chief to even fathom, when you start talking about somebody that is working in your agency that leaves a small child behind.
And he was only on the force for about, what, 6 years?
6 years, yes. And recently received Officer of the Month just a few weeks ago. So I had the opportunity to meet him and shake his hand and congratulate him. But he's an officer that did some great work getting guns off the street, and his relationship with the community and the people he came in contact with. And he's going to be sorely missed. You wish you had 100 more of them, but it's sad that you lost him.
4 officers lost their lives on Monday as a result of this incident, but there were also 4 other officers who were injured to various degrees. What can you tell us this morning about their condition?
Yeah, we were extremely blessed to, I believe all of them have since been released from the hospital. We had at least one that we thought was going to be a little more critical than it was. That officer was released that same day. The other 2 officers did have to have some surgery and are going to be expected to have a full recovery. And then later, one of our officers that was not shot but had suffered a broken ankle, that officer had to stay in the hospital for a day or so, but I think he's since been released as well. But their spirits are high. I tell you, I spoke with a couple of them, and they are, you know, just still experiencing that trauma. But at the same time, I think they would do it all over again if they given the opportunity to go in and save lives.
That leads me to this question, because much has been said following incidents like this. For instance, the one in Dallas, Texas, where police officers were also the victim of sniper fire, etc. And you kind of said it Monday at your press conference. You said that what happened on Monday was, quote, a good example of what you try to tell people every single day, that when you put on that uniform, you don't have any guarantees that you'll return home. And yet tens of thousands of men and women around the country do it every single day. How do you explain that?
Yeah, I mean, some say it's a calling. And, you know, I talk about even my journey, the things that I did and didn't hesitate to put myself in danger to protect and serve. And, you know, I'm just one example, and we have officers every single day that do it. We just have to make sure they have the best training, the best equipment, the best mentality to be able to go out and serve our community. So I don't think there is an explanation from it that, you know, you just know what you have to do. And I mean, it's just incredible to see this, to where officers are seeing their peers getting shot and falling, and they're still running in trying to save others, and without hesitation. And I'm just amazed, and I'm honored to be the police chief for this agency to see that. I just think that we are blessed as a community to have such fine men and women that will put themselves on the line like they did Monday.
I know that CMPD and other law enforcement agencies are in the middle of investigating exactly what happened on Monday, and you don't have all of the answers, but do you think that when it's all wrapped up, that you'll find that things could have been or should have been done differently? Or do you think this is just an instance where officers walk into the unknown, and sometimes it goes right and sometimes it goes wrong, and there is no way to predict it?
Yeah, Mike, that's a great question. I literally was just in a meeting with my executive team, and I said at this point in the investigation, I have nothing to Monday morning quarterback at this time. I don't have anything that I have seen and uncovered that said we should have done that or we should have done this. If I could rewind it and do it all over again, we wouldn't do anything. We wouldn't even go there because of the results of what happened. But At the same time, they're serving a warrant. They served a warrant. They were approaching appropriately. This is a tactical team with that Marshals Task Force who trains together, have an awesome training facility in Charlotte. And it's just unfortunate that the person that they were targeting to go and arrest saw them coming to the residence before they were able to get to the residence, and also had the higher ground, which is always an advantage when you are in a situation like this.
I read, and we're going to talk about this with our two reporters in a moment, that police recovered an AR-15 rifle and a 40 caliber handgun, along with additional magazines. And I read this morning in the paper that because the suspect had the high ground, he was evidently shooting from a second story window, his rounds were piercing the body armor that these officers were wearing. Was he using the AK-47?
Yes, the majority of the shots fired, we still have to go through that, but from what I've seen on the body-worn camera footage and what I could hear, the majority of the fire was rapid suppression from the AK-47. It was piercing body armor. However, there were officers that were shot in the leg, things where body armor is not present, but it was just really traumatic to sit and hear the number of rounds and to see the officers falling, and also the return rounds that officers were attempting to eliminate the threat. And so, yeah, but the individual was firing from both ends of the house, going from one end to the other. And so officers really were at a total disadvantage at that point.
Let me ask you a question. There's been a lot of discussion about whether or not these high-powered automatic or semi-automatic rifles, which were designed for warfare and not for hunting or any other recreational purpose, should even be allowed to be sold to individuals. And I will probably never get an answer to that question in this country because of the Second Amendment. But I'm curious about the photograph that's in the Charlotte Observer this morning of the front of that house. Clearly that is damaged. It's almost destroyed. Clearly, it must be damaged from police return fire. Would that be accurate?
Yes, I'm not familiar with the photograph you're talking about. There was also some damage to where we did breach the house in order to, because at one point we thought that there could have been another suspect inside the residence. We did breach the house to send in some devices to check and clear the house, and we had to clear the house as well. So that took a little bit of time, and that was probably the majority of the time, but we had to make sure that our officers were safe and able to get in there and make sure that there were no more assailants inside. So that might be the damage, but there were several projectile holes around windows and things that as the return fire from our officers, but there were hundreds of rounds fired during that incident.
I have about 30 seconds. We don't see the damage caused by these high-powered rifles on human bodies because the media doesn't show it. Maybe they shouldn't. Maybe they should. I don't know, but you have seen it.
Yeah.
Should these rifles, should these weapons be, should they be out there amongst the ordinary citizens who are not soldiers at war?
Yeah. You know, it's difficult for me to say, and I try to stay away from that a little bit because my view is I don't have a need myself for an automatic weapon. I have weapons for hunting and for protection, but I don't have a need for an automatic or a semi-automatic high-powered rifle or anything, AK-47, anything like that. But we also have a Second Amendment, and unless you can eliminate all of them, the people that want them are going to get them.
Chief Johnny Jennings from CMPD, again, our condolences go to you and your department and the family of Officer Ayers this morning. Thank you for taking time to talk about this with us. We appreciate it very much. When we come back, Nick Della Canale from WFAE and Nick Oxner from WBTV will join us. Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, focused on applying Mazda's customer-centric approach for vehicle design to car buying and servicing in order to create an experience centered around the customer. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com. It's Charlotte Talks on listener-funded 90.7 WFAE and WFAE.org. I'm Mike Collins. We're talking about Monday's tragic shooting in Charlotte in which four police officers, members of various branches of law enforcement, lost their lives. Four others were injured. We have with us now two of the reporters who covered this extensively on Monday, WFAE's Nick De La Canal and Nick Oxner, who's the chief investigative reporter at WBTV and also led the CBS Evening News on Monday night with his report about what happened here in Charlotte, because it was on all of the national networks. It was the lead story. This happened early afternoon, Nick Oxner, when what was described as a combined law enforcement task force, but led by the U.S. Marshals Fugitive Task Force, approached this house in the 5,000 block of Galway Drive in East Charlotte to serve a warrant. Why did this, maybe you don't know the answer to this question, but why did this require a combined law enforcement task force?
Well, this is what this group does, and it's one of these fugitive task force kind of led by and organized by the U.S. Marshals Service. But there are these task force all over the country. The one here in our area, as I understand it, has existed for many years. It's made up of all sorts of local and state and federal agencies and personnel. And so this is what they do. They go execute arrest warrants to take people that they've deemed to be potentially violent or dangerous. And they work in groups like this because, you know, again, these are arrests that you don't want to make by yourself. And I think, obviously, we know how Monday's warrant service played out. And so they apparently were right to think that this could be violent and dangerous for them.
So how many members of law enforcement were part of that initial team that approached the house, and how many members of CMPD and other agencies ultimately came to the scene after the shots were fired?
I'm not sure that I know how many were in that initial task force group. That might be out there, but I don't know it off the top of my head. But we do know from Chief Jennings at a media briefing Monday is that one member on the task force that was in that initial group that went to the house was a CMPD sergeant who was able to get on his CMPD radio and call for backup pretty immediately. And that's what got, you know, a very swift response from CMPD patrol officers in the area.
Nick De La Canal, take us through, as best you can, the sequence of events in terms of when this task force arrived and what happened next.
Right. So this started to unfold around 1:30 on Monday when, you know, this group of officers with the task force showed up to this home in the Shannon Park neighborhood in East Charlotte. And from what we've heard from police, it was as officers were starting to approach the house that they were met with gunfire that was coming from the second story. And this turned into a shootout with officers. You know, as Nick mentioned, they called for backup. The SWAT team arrived. There was an armored vehicle that got called in. And this lasted for nearly 3 hours until at some point, and I think it's still unclear exactly when, the shooter exited the house and officers shot him in the front yard. And then, you know, as Jennings said afterwards, there was still some speculation that there could have been a second shooter. So officers moved in with this armored vehicle and kind of tore apart the front of the house. That was sort of that damage that you were seeing. And they did find two people that were inside the house, two women. One was an adult woman. The other was a 17-year-old. And they were taken into custody. They've been cooperating with the investigation. No charges have been filed against them as of now.
And both of the police recovered, evidently, an AR-15 rifle and a 40 caliber handgun, along with additional magazines and ammunition for both. Were both weapons used to fire on police? And do we know if they were both used? Were they both used by the suspect? Or is that still under investigation?
I think that is still under investigation. We did hear from Jennings just now that they are very certain that the AR-15 style rifle was perhaps the primary firearm that was used. As he said too, that is a, you know, it's a very dangerous weapon and it can pierce the standard bulletproof vest that officers are wearing. And it sounds like that is what happened. So I think that they're still figuring out, you know, how much was the rifle, how much was the handgun.
Nick Oxner, the suspect has been identified as Terry Clark Hughes Jr., who was wanted for being a felon, possessing a firearm, and for eluding arrest in Lincoln County, which is just to the west of us. Do we know how he obtained the firearms, or are they just normally available to anybody who wants them?
We don't know yet how he obtained the firearms. I would suspect that is very much a subject of part of that investigation. We know that agents with the Federal Bureau of Alcohol, Tobacco, and Firearms and Explosives were on scene, on Monday. And the main thing that an ATF agent would do in this case is start tracing those firearms and figure out how they got in the hands of a felon. Again, the suspect was a felon, so it was illegal for him to have these weapons, and yet he had them. And so we see a lot of federal cases made involving straw purchases, people who get firearms, who can buy them legally and hand them to people who can't own them. Again, I don't know that we have yet ventured into that space yet here to know definitively, but we know he couldn't just walk into a store and buy them on his own.
So what do we know, Nick Oxner, about this man's record? Because he clearly had a long record. I read today there were something like 4 dozen arrests, or not, maybe it was arrests, I think. Well, charges. Talk about his record.
Yeah, it has been extensive. And my colleague David Hodges at WBTV has been working on this since the incident, since we learned his name Monday night. His last stint in prison, I think he got out in 2017, if I recall correctly. It was about a 6-year stint, if I recall. And his charges have been in other counties all over the state. I think these were the first time he'd been charged or interacted with police in Lincoln County. The other interesting thing, though, is in addition to his convictions, he'd faced a number of other charges that were either still pending at the time of Monday's incident or had been dismissed as well. So, the last time he had been convicted of something and served a prison sentence had been several years ago, but he had had other interactions with law enforcement much more recently.
Nick DeLocanel, I don't know whether you can answer this question. I'm going to ask it anyway. Due to the nature of his previous arrests and due to the nature of the warrant they were serving him with for being a fugitive felon in possession of a firearm, does it seem odd that law enforcement didn't anticipate that this incident might have occurred?
I think that is a very good question, and I think that that's probably at the top of what the police department is looking into with this investigation. Did they take the proper precautions? Should they have anticipated him firing on officers in the way that he did? And I will say, just also to add sort of on what we know about the shooter, we just talked about sort of his very extensive criminal record, which does go back to like 2001, I think, even just here in North Carolina. But also in terms of like who he was as sort of a person as well. So yesterday I did actually go out to the scene and to that house on Galway Drive. And when I was there, there was a woman who was kind of standing on the curb in front of the house who I went and talked to, who said that she told me that she was actually very close to the shooter and had known him for about 12 years. I think that they had sort of a romantic relationship. And she had kind of come out to the house to try to just understand what had happened. And she'd actually shown me some text messages that she had exchanged with him. And as recently as last Thursday, he had actually sent a text message saying that, watch the news. If something happens, you'll know. And so it sounds like, and to add to that, too, he had told her as well that, he didn't want to go back to prison. He didn't want to leave his 3 kids. Apparently, he had 3 children. So it sounds like perhaps he was expecting, or at least suspecting, that officers perhaps were going to come to try to arrest him.
So he lived in the house, to the best of our knowledge.
Yes. And I talked with a neighbor as well who said that he had seen him living there for about 3 months.
Okay. U.S. Marshals and various law enforcement entities serve warrants and make arrests every single day of the year, many times a day across the country. Clearly, this suspect was both dangerous and desperate. You just said he didn't want to go back to jail, and he didn't want to be taken into custody again. CMPD Chief Johnny Jennings made a point of telling reporters at a press conference earlier this week that officers know that they will be called on to do certain things and walk into the line of fire.
The bravery of our officers that responded to the scene, knowing that they're going into gunfire, is what I've been saying for many years, is in the face of danger, our people step up, and this profession steps up, and that's what we should be defined as doing.
Would there have been, Nick, I know you know a little bit about the military, would there have been any way to either defend themselves from this or take precautions that would have protected the officers from the fire that they experienced and the result that they experienced?
When you're walking into an ambush, you're walking into an ambush. I mean, we heard the chief talk this morning, and we heard him talk yesterday at this press conference about, you know, the shooter had the tactical advantage of being, you know, up, right, and elevated and shooting down at these officers and agents. You know, I think the only real thing you could say is, you know, they could have not gone or, you know, done it. Additional surveillance, but no, I mean, I think the use of the word ambush, which we heard the chief use for the first time yesterday morning at his press conference, seems exactly to be what this is. They went, you know, it wasn't one or two people, it was this group of people. And so, you know, it was a tough situation from the very beginning.
In your reporting on this on WBTV, Nick, you talked to several people in the neighborhood, and they described it sounding like a war zone, like Vietnam, with hundreds of rounds being fired and people climbing onto other homes' rooftops to take sniper positions, and people, police officers coming into their homes to shoot from bedroom windows, etc. How long did this all go on? How long did the shooting portion of this last?
Yeah, my understanding from talking with folks who, you know, endured this and neighbors and listening to their stories is that the real shootout part of it lasted for about a half hour or so, maybe a little bit more, but more or less about a half hour. And again, you're absolutely correct that, you know, at least 100 gunshots were fired.
Four officers were killed. I want to remind folks of that. A number of U.S. Marshals, two veteran officers from the North Carolina Department of Adult Correction, and Joshua Iyer, who was a CMPD officer of 6 years. They've all been assisting each other in this. Governor Roy Cooper, who arrived in Charlotte just hours after that shooting on Monday, was here yesterday for a press conference as well and saluted the bravery of these officers who put themselves in harm's way.
For these members of this U.S. Marshals Fugitive Task Force and the Charlotte-Mecklenburg Police on patrol who responded so quickly and so bravely when help was needed, dangerous assignments are part of the job, but they step up and do it anyway to protect our communities and protect our families.
And, of course, four other officers were injured in this shooting. And on Monday night, CMPD Chief Johnny Jennings mentioned honoring Officer Iyer just this last month.
It was just last month I was in this very room congratulating Officer Iyer for becoming Officer of the Month in April. And he certainly dedicated his life and gave his life to serve our citizens, and I ask that you will keep him and his family and all of the others that fell victim this afternoon. Keep everyone in your prayers.
Nick Della Canal, what do we know about Officer Iyers? He was a young man. He has a three-year-old son.
Yes, he had been with the police department for 6 years. As you mentioned, he'd just been named Officer of the Month in April. We know that he was also a member of the North Carolina Army National Guard and had been deployed overseas twice. In fact, all of the officers who were killed were longtime veterans. And we also know that all of the officers who were killed do have wives and children who have now been left behind.
In the heat of the moment, as these things unfold, sometimes the reporting is wrong or it's not completely full because we don't know. We're learning things just as viewers and listeners and readers of newspapers are learning them. The New York Times reported that according to police, this is on Monday or Tuesday, as officers approached the house, the suspect opened fire, striking several officers. When he stepped out of the house holding a gun, officers judged that he posed an imminent deadly threat and shot him. And he was later pronounced dead in his front yard. Have any of the details of any of this incident, Nick Oxner, changed since Monday or Tuesday?
I think the biggest shifting thing, so let's first stop and stomp down a little bit. Monday afternoon, the scene went on for a long time. And because of that, we didn't hear from police until hours after this incident started. I think the press conference was around 6 o'clock, more or less. And I'm not faulting the police. They actually did the, you know, yeoman's job of updating us via Twitter or X to the extent they could. But just this, the nature of this was shifting. And then also, right, the nature of the task force initially means it's a multi-agency thing. Then CMPD came, then you had a response from every agency around. So it was a lot of moving parts and pieces. And so by the time we heard a press conference, they waited to make sure they understood the situation, understood the casualty situation, and got their facts right. But the biggest thing that I think has shifted from Monday to Tuesday was whether or not there was a second person shooting from inside the house. Because at that first press briefing on Monday, I think they were still operating under the impression that there was a second person firing shots. And that does not appear to be the case now.
And Nick Delacanal, there were two other people in the house, an adult woman and a 17-year-old woman in the house. Do we know the relationship of those people to the suspect yet?
We don't. We do not know the relationship. Yesterday when I was in the neighborhood and I was talking to neighbors, and this was something we asked even their next door neighbors, he wasn't sure. So that's sort of an open question. Yeah, we're not sure.
Johnny Jennings or the police are saying that they're being cooperative with police at the moment. This was one of the deadliest attacks on law enforcement in the country in recent years. CMPD Chief Johnny Jennings described Monday's shooting as the most tragic of his more than three decades with the department. And in the last 31 years, there have only been two other incidents with multiple officer deaths in Charlotte. On Monday afternoon, Mayor Vi Lyle spoke movingly about the officers who lost their lives in this incident.
They lost their lives after they gave us the opportunity to be in a safe place, and they lost their lives. These are people that care deeply about what they've done for a profession, and now today we have to say to them how much we are grateful for what they have done.
But both the governor and President Biden were in touch with Mayor Lyles and probably others involved in this, Nick Oxner. I don't know how much you know about this, but in 30 seconds, do we know what they said? What can be said?
No, I think it's the calls you make in situations like these, which unfortunately are becoming, you know, old hat for folks in office, you know, offering support. Remember, this was also a federal agent. At least one of them was a federal agent and others on a federal task force. And so certainly monitoring the situation.
When we come back from the break, we're going to talk about the emotional toll that this takes on the people who are charged with protecting us in the community. We'll do that when we come back at Charlotte Talks on WFAE. Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, using Mazda's customer-centric approach to cars to create a car buying and servicing experience where the customer is the center of their business. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com. It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE and WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. We're talking about the tragic shooting in Charlotte on Monday that involved many officers, all of them. It seemed hundreds of police officers were there, but four lost their lives. Four others were injured. One of the people who lost their life was Joshua Iyer, who is a six-year veteran of CMPD. We have to remember that these are human beings behind these badges that law enforcement wears. And when an incident like this occurs, the psychological and emotional toll has to be taken into account. So I want to bring in Dr. Amanda Jamieson into this conversation for a moment. Dr. Johnson is a licensed psychologist and executive director of Presby Psych and a mental health trauma expert. Thank you for joining us this morning.
Thank you for having me.
You're welcome. People who voluntarily become soldiers, people who voluntarily go into law enforcement, know, I think, in the back of their minds that something like this can happen. But does anything prepare them for when it happens?
Well, yes, I do. Our officers and law enforcement are trained extensively. They're overtrained to serve and protect our communities. And And in doing so, have the support of strong teams. And I do believe that that serves as a strong protective factor against trauma reactions or long-term trauma reactions, especially when an individual feels that they can turn to their team and say, hey, this was hard. I'm experiencing something difficult in the aftermath.
When these happen to civilians in civilian locations, because we've had many and far too many incidents of people walking in with high-powered guns to businesses and people losing their lives as a result of that, and those businesses generally don't go back to work the next day. But the folks in law enforcement put that uniform on again on Tuesday. They put it on this morning. They will put it on tomorrow, in spite of all of the loss of life that occurred here on Monday. And Johnny Jennings, the chief of police, veteran of 3 decades on the force, became emotional talking about this at a press briefing yesterday.
You know, the last few days have it's just been very tough. And knowing that you have families that are hurting right now. We'll get through it, though.
So, Doctor, how do individuals and organizations who have been through this kind of trauma get through it?
Yeah, a lot of ways. Support from their teams, from their peers, from their leads and superiors. Being accessible and connected to family and friends or faith-based communities, seeking outside counsel through therapy and trained professionals. And also going to, like Chief Jennings mentioned, to your department's Office of Employee Wellness, which offers rich resources and consultation and short-term treatment referral services for a host of supports available. They are not, they may have specialized training, but they are not immune to the trauma and to the reactions that we as humans experience to trauma.
Yeah, people who are in the military, people who put themselves in harm's way as police officers, there seems to be a camaraderie, a sense of a band of brothers, to steal the name of a movie, that may help them support each other in all of this. But even if they think they have weathered the storm of tragedies like this, are there signs that they can look for in each other, that they can look for in themselves, that family members can look for in them to know that they need help, more help perhaps than they've already gotten?
Absolutely. So I would break those down into 4 main categories: emotional, physical, cognitive, and behavioral. And not everyone associates the symptoms or side effects they might be experiencing to, oh my goodness, this might be a reaction to that awful thing that happened. Emotional side effects or reactions might be fear, guilt, grief, denial, anxiety, shock, numbness, and apathy, anger, depression, emotional outbursts. Physical reactions might include chills, fatigue, nausea, upset stomach, racing heart or chest pains, shortness of breath, and excessive sweating. Cognitive reactions might be things like, I just can't concentrate like I usually do. I seem out of it, or my partner or my peer seems not himself. They seem confused or hypervigilant, just a heightened startle response perhaps. And, or it might be experiencing and talking about nightmares or flashbacks. And then behavioral reactions might include things like withdrawal and isolation, restlessness, pacing back and forth. I just can't sit still. I need to be moving. I need to be going. And or a loss or increase in appetite or increased alcohol consumption. Any of these can be observed internally or by others on the outside.
These incidents, unfortunately, happen far too frequently, and they seem to be happening with increasing frequency. If this incident on Monday had occurred in 1980, in 1975, in 1968, this community would have come to a full stop, and it probably would have been in trauma itself, the community itself, for a long time. Now we pick up and move on because it happens all of the time. But are there things that people in the community who might be affected by this, who think they aren't because it happens all the time, but now it's here, should be looking for in themselves?
Say any one of those reactions, right? These critical incidents affect specific communities in particular ways. They also affect, through vicarious trauma, the broader community at large. And so anyone, a person does not have to have been there to experience the fear or the guilt or anger and shock of what's happened, or to be feeling fatigued and not up for their usual, you know, interactions with others, feeling like they need a different outlet for emotional or stress relief.
Nick Delacnell and Nick Oxner are still with us. And I know that on Monday, because there were schools nearby this house on Galway Drive, some of these schools went into lockdown. How many schools did that, Nick Delacnell? And how many students do we know were involved?
I believe that there were three area schools that went on lockdown. I'm not sure how many, what the attendance of those schools. Okay. I know that CMS did put out a statement that day, and they warned that, you know, like afternoon school buses were going to be delayed because of this. And certainly I would imagine if I were one of the students in that school, that would be sort of a scary thing.
Do we know what Nick Oxner, do we know what the schools did to notify parents and what the parents' reaction to this was?
Yeah, typically they'd send out some kind of alert phone call and messages to parents in these kinds of situations. Unfortunately, you know, school lockdowns have become a, you know, pretty regular occurrence. Right. And we also, it's worth noting that they had counseling support on hand yesterday, according to CMS, for these students as well.
And Dr. Jameson, there were several students did tell reporters that they were, if they first thought this was just a drill or it wasn't real, and then when they found that it was real, they expressed fear. Are there things that parents of those students, even though they were not immediately connected to what happened on Monday, they're not oblivious to it, it did happen, it happened near them, they went into lockdown, that parents should and teachers should be looking for in these young people?
Sure. Well, as a mother of three who did receive a text from her children's school due to delays in car line and an explanation of why, I can tell you that was a disturbing message to receive. I commend my children's school for the message that they sent and for being prompt with that. But it is frightening to know that there is a dangerous situation or a threatening situation happening, and to not have full information, and to know that you might not receive the full information until after the fact. When your child comes home, there are things that you can do. And what I would recommend in talking with children and families coming together on the subject of community violence are, to one, reassure your child that they are safe, now, even if they weren't safe then, that schools and families and public safety providers work and collaborate together to keep children and youth safe. And those are things like emergency drills and sign out procedures and supervision on playgrounds or locked doors in schools. Talk with your children, ask them what they know. What were they told? You don't always know from the text that was sent to you. And correct any misinformation in child-appropriate language. A child that's 5 years old and a 12th grader are going to, right, have a different level of comprehension of what's happening here. Validate their feelings and let them know that all feelings are okay when bad things happen.
When things like this do unfold, public officials immediately get involved and they make appearances and they speak to the press and they speak to the individuals involved. And yesterday or in the last several days, let's put it that way, Governor Cooper spoke about meeting with some of the wounded officers.
Yesterday, I met with some of the fellow officers and heard stories about these officers who lost their lives. They were good ones, people that you could trust, people who you could count on, and people who would risk their lives. And at the hospital, I also met with some of the families of those killed in the line of duty, and I met one of the wounded officers. What I told them was that the people of North Carolina are grateful for their sacrifice. Together we prayed, together we gave words of comfort. But I know that the emptiness left behind in these families will continue to run deep. And I ask that North Carolinians pray for these families and their law enforcement colleagues who are left behind in this tragedy, and to support those law enforcement officers that they've left behind.
I don't mean to minimize the efforts of the governor or anybody else who spoke to the wounded or the families of the deceased in this incident, but in situations like this, Dr. Jamison, do words help? And what words help?
Words do help. They don't solve or resolve. Some things can only improve over time. I would say more than words, it's presence. You don't have to know the right things. Sometimes it's not saying anything at all. It is bearing witness and showing up for an officer, a family, a community, a child. You don't want to say things like, I understand. I know what you're going through, because you don't. You can't promise something that you can't promise, you don't have control over. You validate feelings. What you experienced is awful. I'm so sorry you had to experience that. How are you now? How can I support you? How can I show up for you? Do you need something? Does your family need something? And, or I am concerned about you and this is what I see. Can I help you? Can I assist you in seeking help?
Dr. Amanda Jamison is the executive director of Presby Psych. I want to thank you for joining us on such short notice, and thank you for your time this morning. The timing of the shootings on Monday was particularly difficult for those who are also marking the fifth anniversary of the shootings at UNC Charlotte, which also had a CMPD component. And a reporter asked Chief Jennings about this yesterday, about how he thought major incidents like what happened here on Monday and the shootings at UNCC impact law enforcement. And his answer, I think, might surprise you.
I truly believe incidents like this makes us stronger. I think it also makes more people that see this and say, I want to be a part of that. They see what we do for the community. They see that we are here to save lives. They see that we're here to ensure that each of you are safe in this community. And I can't think of a more honorable or noble profession.
And Nick Della Canale, how will this incident, and I only have 15 seconds, impact Police Week and the security of the Love and Life Festival this weekend uptown? Do we know?
I do think that this is going to draw more attention to Police Week, certainly with the memorials that are coming up. As far as security for Love and Life, I know that 12 officers are on leave right now because they fired their other weapons, but CMPD is a very large department, so they said it's not going to have much of an effect.
Nick Della Canale from WFAE News and Nick Oxner from WBTV with us today. I'd like to end today by hearing from Terry Bergen. He is a United States Marshal for the Western District of North Carolina. Prior to that, he served more than 45 years with the city of Lincolnton. He spoke at yesterday's press conference from his experience and from his heart, and summed up the dedication he knows to be at the center of why these law enforcement officers do what they do.
Deputy Weeks was one of my team members. I worked with Deputy Weeks over the past 20 years in various assignments. I also knew the other three officers. And I'd like to leave you with this thought. If you could speak to each one of those fallen officers today and ask them the question, why? They'd say, why what? They say, why did you take the oath? Why did you become law enforcement officers? Their response, why not? Second question, Would you do this again, knowing your fate yesterday? Would you do it again? They would be a boisterous yes. They would not change a thing. The only thing they might change is saying, let me lead. Let me lead. They'd get a tussle over who was going in first. That's how brave they were yesterday, and that's how brave they were the day they took the oath of office.
Terry Bergen is a United States Marshal for the Western District of North Carolina. Those marshals were his men.
Celebrating 25 years on the air, Charlotte Talks with Mike Collins is a production of 90.7 WFAE. Support for Charlotte Talks comes from Mazda of South Charlotte. Our executive producer is Wendy Herkey. The senior producers are Gabe Altieri and Sarah D'Elia. Our engineer is Joby Sprinkle. For more information about Charlotte Talks, to listen to past episodes, or subscribe to the podcast, visit wfae.org/charlottetalks. Additional support for WFAE programming comes from the Corporation for Public Broadcasting.
Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, incorporating Mazda's customer-centric vehicle design by making the customer the center of business to create a better car buying experience. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com.